Bond Street Picture Gallery. One of the smaller Bond Street picture galleries, the entrance is from a picture shop. Nearly in the middle of the gallery, there is a writing table at which the secretary, fashionably dressed, sits with his back to the entrance, correcting catalog proofs. Some copies of a new book are on the desk, also the secretary's shining hat and a couple of magnifying glasses. At the side, on his left, a little behind him, is a small door marked private. Near the same side is a cushioned bench parallel to the walls, which are covered with Dubedat's works. Two screens, also covered with drawings, stand near the corners right and left of the entrance. Jennifer, beautifully dressed and apparently very happy and prosperous, comes into the gallery through the private door.
Have the catalogs come yet, Mr. Danby?
Not yet.
What a shame. It's quarter past. The private view will begin in less than half an hour.
I think I'd better run over to the printers to hurry them up.
Oh, if you would be so good, Mr. Danby. I'll take your place while you're away.
If anyone should come before the time, don't take any notice. The commissionaire won't let anyone through unless he knows him. We have a few people who like to come before the crowd. People who really buy. And of course, we're glad to see them. Have you seen the notices in brush and crayon in the easel?
Yes, most disgraceful. They write quite patronizingly, as if they were Mr. Dubedat's superiors. After all the cigars and sandwiches they had from us on press day and all they drank, I really think it is infamous that they should write like that. I hope you have not sent them tickets for today.
Oh, they won't come again. There's no lunch today. The advance copies of your book have come.
Give it to me. Oh, excuse me a moment.
Jennifer runs away with a copy of the book through the private door. The secretary takes a mirror from his drawer and smartens himself before going out. Ridgeon comes in.
Good morning. May I look round as well before the door is open?
Certainly, Sir Colenso. I'm sorry, catalogs have not come. I'm just going to see about them. Here's my own list, if you don't mind.
Thanks. What's this?
That's just come in. An advance copy of Mrs. Dubedat's Life of Her Late Husband.
The Story of a King by His Wife.
Ridgeon looks at the portrait inside.
There he is. You knew him here, I suppose?
We knew him better than she did, Sir Colenso, in some ways, perhaps.
So did I. I'll take a look around.
The secretary puts on the shining hat and goes out. Ridgeon begins looking at the pictures. Presently, he comes back to the table for a magnifying glass and scrutinizes a drawing very closely. He sighs, shakes his head, as if constrained to admit the extraordinary fascination and merit of the work, then marks the secretary's list. Proceeding with his survey, he disappears behind the screen. Jennifer comes back with her book. A look around satisfies her that she's alone. She seats herself at the table and admires the memoir, her first printed book, to her heart's content. Ridgeon reappears, face to the wall, scrutinizing the drawings. After using his glass again, he steps back to get a more distant view of one of the larger pictures. She hastily closes the book at the sound, looks around, recognizes him, and stares, petrified. He takes a further step back, which brings him nearer to her.
Clever brute.
Jennifer flushes as though Ridgeon had struck her. He turns to put the glass down on the desk and finds himself face to face with her intent gaze.
I beg your pardon. I thought I was alone.
I'm glad we have met, Sir Colenso Ridgeon. I met Dr. Blenkinsop yesterday. I congratulate you on a wonderful cure.
Ridgeon can find no words, makes an embarrassed gesture of assent after a moment's silence, and puts down the glass and the secretary's list on the table.
He looked the picture of health and strength and prosperity.
She looks for a moment at the walls, contrasting Blenkinsop's fortune with the artist's fate.
He has been fortunate.
Very fortunate. His life has been spared.
I mean that he has been made a medical officer of health. He cured the chairman of the borough council very successfully.
With your medicines?
No. I believe it was with a pound of ripe plums.
Funny.
Yes. Life does not cease to be funny when people die, any more than it ceases to be serious when people laugh.
Dr. Blenkinsop said one very strange thing to me.
What was that?
He said that private practice in medicine ought to be put down by law. When I asked him why, he said that private doctors were ignorant, licensed murderers.
That is what the public doctor always thinks of the private doctor. Well, Blenkinsop ought to know. He was a private doctor long enough himself. Come, you have talked at me long enough. Talk to me. You have something to reproach me with. There is reproach in your face, in your voice. You are full of it. Out with it.
It is too late for reproaches now. When I turned and saw you just now, I wondered how you could come here coolly to look at his pictures. You answered the question. To you, he was only a clever brute.
Oh, don't. You know I did not know you were here.
You think it mattered only because I heard it, as if it could touch me or touch him. Don't you see that what is really dreadful is that to you living things have no souls?
The soul is an organ I have not come across in the course of my anatomical work.
You know you would not dare to say such a silly thing as that to anybody but a woman whose mind you despise. If you dissected me, you could not find my conscience. Do you think I have got none?
I have met people who had none.
Clever brutes. Do you know, Doctor, that some of the dearest and most faithful friends I ever had were only brutes? You would have vivisected them. The dearest and greatest of all my friends had a sort of beauty and affectionateness that only animals have. I hope you may never feel what I felt when I had to put him into the hands of men who defend the torture of animals because they are only brutes.
Well, did you find us so very cruel after all? They tell me that though you have dropped me, you stay for weeks with the Bloomfield Boningtons and the Walpoles. I think it must be true, because they never mention you to me now.
The animals in Sir Ralph's house are like spoiled children. When Mr. Walpole had to take a splinter out of the mastiff's paw, I had to hold the poor dog myself. And Mr. Walpole had to turn Sir Ralph out of the room. And Mrs. Walpole has to tell the gardener not to kill wasps when Mr. Walpole is looking. But there are doctors who are naturally cruel, and there are others who get used to cruelty and are callous about it. They blind themselves to the souls of animals, and that blinds them to the souls of men and women. You made a dreadful mistake about Louis, but you would not have made it if you had not trained yourself to make the same mistake about dogs. You saw nothing in them but dumb brutes, and you could see nothing in him but a clever brute.
I made no mistake whatever about him.
Oh, doctor.
I made no mistake whatever about him.
Have you forgotten that he died?
He is not dead. He is there, in his paintings, and there, in the book.
Put that down. How dare you touch it?
Ridgeon, amazed at the fierceness of the outburst, puts the book down with a deprecatory shrug. She takes it up and looks at it as if he had profaned a relic.
I am very sorry. I see I had better go.
I beg your pardon. I forgot myself. But it is not yet. It is a private copy.
But for me, it would have been a very different book.
But for you, it would have been a longer one.